Welcome to Rocket Talk, the Tor.com podcast. I'm Justin Landon, and I am joined by two of the finest commentators in science fiction and fantasy, Natalie Lurs and Jenny Thurman. Natalie blogs at Radish Reviews. She's a former editor at Romantic Times and is now an editor at Mask Books. Jenny blogs at Jenny's Library, but really her Twitter feed is more frequently where she drops knowledge. She has a master's in library of science. Welcome to both of you.
Hello.
Awesome. Well, I'm really excited to have you both here tonight. What I'm going to do is we're just going to jump right into this because we've got a long discussion ahead of us. We're here tonight to talk about the Hugo Awards and specifically the short fiction ballot for the Hugo Awards. So without bandying around the bush too much, let's just get into our first story, which is Rachel Swirsky's If You Were a Dinosaur, My Love. The story is essentially about a woman who is imagining what her life and her partner's life would be like if her partner was a Tyrannosaurus Rex and was able to protect himself against the abuse that he suffered that has put him in a hospital bed. So Natalie, before we came on to the show, we had a chance to chat just a little bit about this story. And I think one of the things that's most exciting about it is the structure that Swirsky employs. She does this neat if you were a repetition thing that I think works really well. What's your kind of first take on this story?
If you were, you know, if, and the repetition of like the last line of the previous paragraph into the next, and the imagery is really great, but I had some problems with actually the meat of the story.
What did you think, Jenny, at first blush?
Well, I actually love it because it is making clear references to stories that I read to kids all the time, which just kind of cracks me up and really is not something I see very often. So the repetition that Natalie was talking about, that's taken very directly, at least as far as I can tell, from If You Give a Mouse a Cookie. It has the same kind of basic structure, and they're both circular stories. She's clearly doing that as well, although she does a more adult twist on it, obviously. And just the whole fact that she is referencing a children's book, a children's picture book that is meant to be comforting to children, with the repetition and everything, in a story that is in the end not at all comforting and is about a woman who is trying to comfort herself but really can't because this is the real world and the adult world and crap happens and you can't undo it. And just that juxtaposition I thought was incredibly clever.
And I would argue that perhaps until about the halfway point, it is pretty comforting at first until it sort of turns. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, I guess when she actually talks about the violence that's happened to her partner, and that's when it sort of reconfigures the way you're reading it. Natalie, you talked about kind of losing touch with it as you got into the meat of the story and you'd read it a few times. I reread it just before we started because I was wanting to reread it again. It had been the third or fourth time that I'd read it. And I kind of started to dislike it, too, the more I read it. although I don't know if I could put my finger on it the way you will. So What's your problem with it?
Well, my problem is that this story is centering the experience of this woman and how she's feeling about her partner, her presumably male fiance, who has been essentially gay bashed or trans bashed. I mean, he's clearly been assaulted in a violent way because of perceived gender or sexual identity. And it feels like it's almost an appropriation of that situation. And it's feels like almost a cheap emotional stunt to a certain extent. It bothered me. The more I thought about it, the more it really bothered me that this is all about her pain.
Right. The narrator's pain, right?
Yeah.
And not the pain of the victim.
Yeah. The man who's in a coma who may never wake up again.
Right. It's all about how she'll feel when he gets married, even in the beginning, before it talks about the actual violence, talks about her feelings as he's getting married to somebody more like him and, you know, to a T-Rex, a dinosaur, not to her, even though she would be. It's all about her emotions, not his feelings of joy, her feelings of loneliness, even before you get into that stuff. I agree with you. I think it's an interesting decision. I also think it's interesting that it's sort of become a one-size-fits-all story by using all of the different pejoratives that are used, that the men who beat her partner, it's a laundry list of terms, and it sort of becomes one size fits all. Like, it's not really directed at any sort of thing. It can be sort of whatever you want. I don't know if the story loses some power because of that.
I think it does. I don't think the epithets are really earned
Yeah, I do agree with that. That seemed very, I mean, I have honestly have only read it twice now rather than three or four times like you guys. So maybe I read it more, will change my mind. But I can see what you're saying about everything else, but I don't know that I still quite agree with it. But I do agree with the part about where it just seems so general that it doesn't, it isn't, it's trying to apply to too many people rather than being specific about what is actually happening to these people.
Yeah, there's a very particular line. It's toward the end of the story, the last first sentence of the last paragraph. It says, "If you were a dinosaur, my love, then nothing could break you. And if nothing could break you, then nothing could break me." And I think that's sort of what you're getting at, Natalie, if you put aside the fact that it's sort of appropriating some, you know, somebody else's experience. But it is also about this very self-centered emotional context, which is interesting. I don't know if many people are reading it that way.
I'm not sure. I mean, and, you know, the imagery is absolutely gorgeous. Like the part in the church where she pulls the hydrangea out of the vase and puts it against her heart and she turns into this flower. I mean, that's like an amazing image. And that to me is the pivot of the story where, you know, it's very, not quite positive, but then it sort of pivots around that point.
There's also this very interesting revenge aspect to it. Did you guys have any sort of reaction to that? Into sort of this, like, it gets very violent in its reaction to what the T-Rex would do to these abusers. And I don't have any problem with it per se, but it's an interesting how violent it feels to me in that way.
But I think this is one of the ways in which the fact that it is about her pain actually works, because I think part of the point of that is to validate that, but also recognize the fact that, you know, these are not monsters we're talking about. They're not T-Rexes, neither, you know, the person she loves that's in a coma, nor the people who did this to him. They are people, and they have other people that love them as well. Like, that's the part that I thought really worked well, actually.
Do you think it's possible, Natalie, that she meant for this to be as about her pain as much as it's do you think that was intentional?
It's an incredibly well-crafted story. I can't imagine that it's not intentional. You know, I mean, it's told from a very tight, limited point of view. You know, it's all inside the head of the narrator.
Well, I think it fits with the fact that it's referencing, again, picture books and mm-hmm. how much that is about the way that that parent-child relationship works and how much parents tend to, how much of their lives are about their children's. But then it raises the question, I think Natalie's right, about how appropriate and really healthy that is. For both parties when it comes to relationships among adults, among peers.
And that's a very interesting way of putting it with the narrator as sort of in that parent role and this abused man partner of hers that's in the, I guess, in the child role. I mean, she's reading it to him, right?
Right.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and then I'm thinking about, you know, if he wakes up.
Right.
Is she going to guilt trip him for all the things she did for him for the rest of his life? You know, I'm just trying to think of from the unhealthy parent-child relationship that Jenny brought up.
Yeah.
You know, I could see this going down that road.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, she's going to be a martyr.
I will say, if you remove all of the thematic stuff that we're talking about right now, and you just pull it out and you just look at the story from a structural perspective, I think it's probably my favorite story of the ballot, because I really, really love the structure of it and the appropriation of the children's sort of structure. But just the language. I mean, I just think it's a really beautifully written story.
Yes, it is.
Absolutely.
I mean, from a craft perspective, I don't know that you could do much better, particularly in something that's, what is this thing, 1,000 words? If that.
Yeah.
I look at this story and it's been nominated and we've talked about it's powerfully written. It's obviously by a very prolific short fiction writer, but I'm very interested in the fact that it's been nominated, and I can't help but wonder if it's been nominated in part, you know, putting aside the fact that it's a great story, the fact that it's just so short, that it was on Apex, it was on Apex Magazine, it was available free on the internet, and it's short. I mean, a lot of people read this thing, right? I mean, I have to think like that was sort of an advantage for it.
Well, I think in terms of a lot of people reading it and it being short is part of that, but I also think the fact that it's readable is a part of that too. Like, it's a combination of the two because it can be short and you still don't want to finish it. But this, you definitely want to finish.
Yeah, very, very accessible, which we'll get into later. I don't think that's necessarily true of all the stories on the ballot. This is a very accessible story. And the children's structure totally plays into that, I think.
Right, because that's a reference that a lot of people are going to get because it's an extremely popular children's book. And it's been out long enough that adults remember it as kids.
I certainly do.
I do not, but I think I'm the oldest of our group at the moment, so.
It did come out when I was a kid. Like, it wasn't around before I was a kid, if that makes sense.
I mean, I remember, I mean, I've read the book because I do have children in my life, but I don't have children on an ongoing basis in my life, so I don't encounter children's books too often, unfortunately.
I believe I was the debut audience for If You Give a Mouse a Cookie, but my daughter now has If You Give a Moose a Pancake, If You Give a...
some muffin.
Yes, yes. there are so many of them.
Just there and the rest of them.
It's never ending.
Never. Yeah, it's a real cash cow.
It's a whole series.
There are as many If You Give a books as there are like Jim Butcher books or like Harry Dresden books.
Well, and it's also, I think it's also referencing another children's picture book series, which is Jane Yolen and Mark Teague's How Do Dinosaurs? And it's a whole series of How Do Dinosaurs Eat Their Food? How Do Dinosaurs Say Goodnight? And in the stories, it's all about, you know, do they smash and, you know, crash and all that sort of stuff. And the story is supposed to go, no, they don't. They're super nice. Like, they're polite, etc. And I saw that, and of course the fact that it's a dinosaur we're talking about, but also just the fact that what we were talking about before, where there's this revenge aspect, but then she pulls away from it. So it seemed like that was kind of in there too, which I found really interesting. But anyway.
Yeah, I haven't heard her speak about this story and sort of where it came from. I think that would be a fun conversation to sort of see what she's actually kind of referencing within the children's books, which one she had read. Okay, so I think our overall verdict on this one is very well written, but perhaps slightly problematic in a couple of ways.
Yes.
Well, and also how speculative actually is it?
Well, it's not. I mean, at least arguably it's not. I mean, it's there's sort of this wish fulfillment of the narrator who's saying it would be great if the world was this way, if it was a world mm-hmm. that had magic, and if it was a world that had these aspects, but it doesn't have them, I don't think. I mean, that's the point of the story, is the world doesn't have them.
See, I don't know. I think I disagree with that, but that is probably a much more complicated conversation about what I think speculative fiction actually looks like in children's picture books. But
I'm interested.
Well, it's just it's just the fact that oftentimes when they do give out awards for, say, children's picture books that are speculative fiction or specifically science fiction, they tend to, people that do those awards tend to go for things that have the window dressing of it, where they have aliens or things like that. They happen in space or whatever, but it could have happened. It could be a story that could have happened anywhere, such as, you know, it's a retelling of Goldilocks and the Three Bears, but it has to do with aliens, kind of a thing. Whereas I think a lot of the stuff that's really more in line with what speculative fiction does for adults are things that are more imaginative, but not quite as concrete as far as what's reality and what's not. So I think it actually fits really well in that sense.
I'm glad you're here to offer that perspective, because that's
sorry, is that random and confusing.
No, because it's not a perspective that I would see. I mean, I look at this the story and I see sort of this you know, beautiful story that's not speculative. Personally, I don't really struggle with the fact that it's not traditionally speculative. I mean, there's a lot of stories on the ballot. I mean, I think you can make a case that on the novella ballot with Wakula Springs, that's not very speculative either. And I don't really have a particular problem with that if it's on the Hugo ballot or not, but I may be unique in that. Do you care, Natalie?
Not particularly. I was just bringing that up as a point.
Okay.
Some people may care.
Oh, I think a lot of people care. particularly Hugo voters, I think, can care about that kind of stuff. I mean, it's that real passion for it being sort of our genre. So who knows? We'll see.
Yeah, does it count or does it not? That definitely
seems
like
Well, when they're not busy nitpicking the rules.
This is not a Wheel of Time podcast. Okay.
Hate mail comes to me.
All right, let's go on to the next story then. We have... Let's go to my least favorite of the stories. Which is The Ink Readers of Doyce Kett by Thomas Older Hoifelt. I would try to summarize what this story is about, but honestly, I really don't know. Maybe one of you could take a stab at it?
Well, since Natalie liked it, I think she's the one to say.
It's set in Thailand, and it's got this flashback structure, and the central character is a young boy named Tang Mu, and the story opens with him dying. And then we get a flashback, and I really hate this particular flashback structure. I hate it when it happens in TV. I hate it when it happens in my reading. You have the very short flashback, and then you go back, 36 hours previously, and then you get the build-up to the it's a way of building narrative tension. I think I just hate it. But there's a village festival that's happening, and they're waiting for these wishes to kind of come down the river. And then they fulfill the wishes, but then there's like village corruption and all these chains of coincidences that happen. There were parts of that where I think were absolutely beautifully written.
And parts of it are very funny as
yes.
well. It's got a real wit to it at times. It has these weird, what I think are completely unnecessary footnotes. I don't know what you guys thought about those, but I felt like the story was much richer without the footnotes. When you get down to the bottom and it sort of defines what all these words mean, like I actually enjoyed how he was contextually defining the terms within the story, and then he's footnoted what they really mean, which sort of bothers me, just sort of like a structural perspective. But
The one thing I liked about that is it gave me a cultural context for the way some of the characters were described in what I would see as insulting.
Oh, interesting. Okay. That makes sense. When I talked earlier about stories being inaccessible, this is the one I was talking about. I don't find this to be a particularly accessible story. It starts off, the language is certainly more worked than any of the other stories. It's doing a lot of things with its structure, its sentence structure. Personally, I actually enjoy the flashback structure, but I enjoy it when it goes back. I don't like when it's flashback, or it's a present flashback and then present at the end. I mean, I like it when it interweaves it, where you see it more in one of the books that just comes to mind that does it is sort of the Mark Lawrence books, Prince of Thorns, which does that, where it's present, past, present, past, present, past. I enjoy that. I think I agree with you, Natalie, when it's just present and then it goes past, it becomes sort of a cheap trick.
If NCIS uses it as a narrative structure, you maybe should not use it in your short story.
That should be a rule. That is Natalie Lur's editing rule number one.
I mean, and I love me some NCIS, but
dramatic black and white photo.
Yes. Yeah. Chug chug.
So Jenny, what was your first takeaway on this one?
I had a hard time getting through it as well. I know that Natalie was talking about the footnotes giving a cultural context, but I just kept wondering about, how this story comes across to the people who live in the place that he's writing about. And I'm not sure that's not something I feel like I have an answer to, which makes me feel kind of uncomfortable about it. And I think part of what makes me feel even more uncomfortable in that sense is that, the main character is supposedly Tang Mu, and it feels like he's really just sort of a plot point in a sense. Like, he doesn't come alive for me in any way. None of the characters do. They have a lot of personality, but they seem more like caricatures than actual characters. And it's maybe just a personal thing of mine, but I kind of hate stories that do that. And I really don't like stories that have children that are wise before their age. And although that's not precisely what's going on here, it's that same kind of thing. And it just, not something I like at all.
I do agree about how the people who live in Thailand, in the area the story is set, how they would feel about it, because I know very little about the country and its culture. That was something I was thinking of as I was reading through it, too, is like, how authentic is this?
Well, and one of the things that I struggled with, and one of the things I really like in short stories, is I want to know who the narrator is. Do we know who the narrator is here?
No. Which I think is making all of that even more problematic, actually, because it's this omniscient voice, and considering like what we just talked about, that's really not the best, not the kind of choice that's going to make me feel more confident about any of that, I guess I should say.
Yeah, I'm looking at the story right now. It's a very distant third person omniscient.
It actually reminds me in that way quite a bit of the Yi Lil Yu story that won 2 years ago. And it had the sort of the same thing. It didn't really have characters. It had characters, but they were not the central character. They just sort of moved through all these different characters with an omniscient voice just like this. And the story left me very cold, which is exactly what this story does. It leaves me very cold. I'm impressed with it by the sentence level. Like, I'll read a sentence and be like, wow, that's a killer sentence. Way to go, Older Hoyfelt. And then I'll read a paragraph maybe and be like, oh, that's a great paragraph. But together, like, it just didn't connect for me.
Yeah.
Like, I love the bit about the dragonflies. The second paragraph is great. You know, the child-free by choice dragonflies.
Yeah, I'm just going to make Justin's editing rule number 101, that, like, if you're going to use ejaculate in the second paragraph, like, you need to make it count. And for me, it just didn't work. It just kind of threw me right out, you know? New rule.
Well, and I also, I mean, that is then repeated at the end with all these supposed good things that happen after he dies. And as far as I can tell, he's going for this like ironic sort of juxtaposition of tragedy, but, you know, all this karmic good stuff happening kind of thing, which I really feel kind of inadequate to kind of explain exactly what the point of that is. But what bothered me about that actually was the part about his father, where his father was brain damaged, but in such a way that he's now no longer sad that his child is dead. And I think a part of it bothered me because to the extent that we have a main character, it is the kid that died, whose father now is no longer sad that he's dead, and just how horrific that would be to just about any child. Like, that's almost, because that is more of a real fear to children than dying, like, that's almost something they fear more than death. So, and I don't feel like the story recognized that, because it's not written for children, it's written for adults, but it bothered me, so.
Nor is the voice it's written in conducive to even being able to portray that.
Right.
It's not a tight third person. It's not first person, which is, I guess, really part of the challenge. And for me, and we'll get into this a little bit more when we talk about the Hugo ballad at large and maybe even some historical Hugo ballads, I always find Hugo's stories tend to really trade on emotion. Like, they tend to really be emotionally to carry emotional impact. And this story doesn't for me. It's cold. And it makes it a weird choice on the ballot for me. It's one of those stories that I'll be really interested to see when we get the breakdown, when this is all over. Like, how many nominations did it get? Was it toward the bottom of the group? Did it only make it on by one nomination? I mean, I think you can look at it from a literary perspective and say it's a great story, but is it a great story to read? Is it a fun story to read? Am I glad I read it? No.
Yeah.
No. What about you? Natalie, are you glad you read it?
Yeah, I kind of am. One thing now I'm like reconsidering. I'm like, oh, this story sucks. I don't know now. But one thing I noticed about the story, which neither of you have mentioned, is that in the story, everybody gets their wish except for Tangmu. Tangmu doesn't want to die. It's the only thing Tangmu wishes for, and he dies. Everybody else in the story gets their wish.
Well, isn't not dying the one thing you can't ever have? I mean, like,
Well, I mean, he doesn't want to die the way he dies. He doesn't want to, you know, be drowned.
And I guess that kind of encapsulates what bothers me about it, and that I don't, not that I need my stories to always have meaning, although I am, you know, that's one of the pitfalls of being used to reading books for kids, is that they do tend to. But, like, I expect it to mean something to me, I guess, is a better way of putting it. And I don't know what to make of that, honestly. And it's not even something that, like, gets my, you know, the gears turning in my head kind of thing. I don't even know what to do with it.
Yeah. I wish I knew more about Buddhism, because I suspect this sort of lack of desire that Tangmu has through the whole story is, I suspect it's probably very Buddhist in its sensibility, but I don't know enough about the various many traditions to even make a guess.
Yeah, I'm also fully willing to admit that I may be bouncing on this story strictly because I'm reading it from a heavily Western perspective, and I just can't, like, I read the places and the names and the philosophies that are behind it, and I just, it's just bouncing off me. I mean, I fully admit that's possible, and...
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, ditto here. Sorry to interrupt you.
I wish that wasn't the case. I mean, I wish I didn't struggle with that, but I definitely do.
Because the monk talks about, you know, non-attachment and stuff, which is what Tengu has. He's not attached.
Right, but I think, I mean, again, maybe this is what Justin's saying about coming at this from a Western perspective, but mm-hmm. again, for me, that goes back to the whole thing about I hate stories that center on children that are wise for their age. I just, and that is actually a Western trope that really annoys the hell out of me, so.
But if you look at some Eastern traditions, you have these children who are anointed as avatars of, you know, Buddha, like, you know, the Dalai Lama, and they have these child goddesses and I think Nepal or Tibet. I am probably completely misremembering, but I just read something just last week. It was very interesting. So you kind of, at least from my Western perspective, I can see that there might be a cultural tradition of that for this story. But again, yet wise beyond their years, it's almost like, you know, the magical older wise black person who yeah. shows up to tell the white
yeah, not quite as
well hero.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. But it's the same thing. It's reducing a character to a type.
Yeah.
We did not like this story as much as some others. So,
yes.
The next one, Selkie Stories Are for Losers by Sophia Samatar, was published at Strange Horizons. Shout out to Strange Horizons. This story is about a girl whose mom leaves, disappears, and she is picking up the pieces of her life afterward, and she meets somebody else who has mom issues. And they deal with it together, I guess you could say. And the speculative element here is the nature of the Selkie, which is, for those who don't know, is a shapeshifter who can take off their seal skin and become a human, and then put their seal skin back on and become a seal and live in the ocean. And I don't know, are Selkies always women?
No,
but they tend to be a lot in the stories.
Yes, and they tend to be objects typically, right? I mean, at least in my experience, they've been that way. I don't know if that's...
Shauna McGuire has Selkies in her Toby Day books, and yeah, they tend to be, I mean, kind of prey animals almost.
Yeah, like the idea, most of the stories center around capturing Selkies by capturing the skin once they've shed it.
Yes.
So.
But then thus trapping them in their human form.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And in this case, the story begins with the main character, who I don't believe is ever named. Is she ever named in the story? I don't think she is. The main character finds an old coat upstairs, and she brings it down, shows it to her mom, and her mom disappears. And we're left wondering, was her mom a Selkie and found her skin and went back to the ocean, or didn't she? And to me, the questions posed by this story are really interesting. Like the way the story is structured and the way it ends really leaves you in the lurch of wondering how the narrator's mother really disappeared, and like what is the nature of her loss and how is she dealing with that loss. It almost worked for me. It didn't quite get there, but it almost did. Natalie, how about for you? I know you have some thoughts.
I read this story as like as essentially basically the mother was dead. And that's just because of my own personal history. My mother died when I was about the same age as the narrator of this story. I was 16 years old. So my lived experience was very different in some ways than the narrator's experience in the story. So I kind of bounced off it a bit for that reason. But that's a very personal, idiosyncratic reaction. So I'm trying to kind of move past that to look at the story as a whole. So, I mean, I like the tension around the disappearance of the mother. You know, is she a Selkie? Did she run off? Did she die? You know, the sort of, yeah, the tension that you can't quite tell.
Right.
You know? And I like the repetition of, like, sort of, you know, the grayish brown swimsuit, the disgusting old coat, the gray hair, the brown hair. You know, I thought that was really cool, too.
What about for you, Jenny?
Yeah, I liked it, but it didn't quite click with me the way some two of the others that we're talking about did. I did like the ambiguity that we've been talking about. And I also liked that everyone in the story felt like someone I could run into in my own hometown. Like, they felt like real people with real problems. Even if, you know, there's a question of whether her problem is that her mother is a Selkie or whether her mother's left or dead, it still felt very realistic in a lot of ways. Like, the people felt like they lived and breathed. But yeah, there was something about it that didn't quite click with me, and I'm not quite sure what it was. It's hard to put my finger on it.
I think I came away from it thinking that her mother committed suicide, and the reason I think that perhaps is that she's looking at Mona, whose mother is suicidal, and that the Selkie story is something that she's created to deal with it, perhaps. I don't know if that's the case. And the last line is very ambiguous, and it references things like people who drop things, who tell all, who leave keys around, who let go. And who leave keys around was interesting to me because there are two instances where keys are mentioned, and one of those is when the very beginning she leaves her keys inside the restaurant, which is where she meets Mona and the girl who she bonds with. And then later on, after work, Mona asks if she has the keys to their car, and that's when they leave and sort of make this decision that they're gonna, you know, be friends or be close. And so I don't know if there's more being referenced that I don't get. I feel like that last line isn't as well crafted as it could have been, that it doesn't clarify perhaps enough. I get maybe that's the point, but I don't know that it clicks with the rest of the story as well as it could. The structure of the story, though, is very cool. I like it. I love these sort of short-hitting bits with hard scene breaks. That's one of my favorite things in short stories. It makes it very readable to me, where you get this great bite of a story and then you immediately break a hard scene break to another scene.
I think it works really well in this story too as well. It fits the story and kind of the state of mind that she's in terms of it feeling kind of disconnected. So
yeah, and I'm looking at the story right now and I'm trying to figure out, do we know what gender or sex the narrator is? Because I don't think we do. We're assuming it's a girl.
Right, because of the way she talks about her mom and her connection to her, but you're right.
Yeah, but I'm looking and the narrator doesn't have a name and there's nothing clear that it's a girl, no. Which I think is interesting too.
Oh, huh. I read it as a female narrator from the get-go.
Yes, so did I. And I think it was a combination of the fact that it's written by a woman and it's talking about a mother, and that's just how the stories tend to be. But you're right, and that's really interesting because it does work.
I mean, one thing I did like about the story was the way the narrator kind of had this guilt blame thing. Like, yeah. You know, they bring the coat downstairs and say, "What is this?" And then that is the trigger for the mother leaving. And I think, you know, children who lose parents often blame themselves.
Oh yeah.
I mean, regardless of how the parent gets lost, that is something that absolutely does happen. So I really liked that part. That part felt very true to me.
Oh, wow. So she's just sort of in that this whole has grown out of her or the narrator's desire to take ownership of her mother's. That's I didn't even think about that angle. I like that. And yeah, the fact that the narrator isn't stated is interesting. But if you look at the way the story's written, the narrator has no real relationship to the father. It's just becomes very strained and distant relationship, and then the only relationship we have is the now gone relationship with the mother and this relationship with this girl Mona. But also we spend time in the locker room with the mother, and I don't know if these are sort of ways, but if this narrator was in the locker room with the mother, then you assume it was a woman, but I don't know.
Well, it's the YWCA. I used to swim at the Y. You would see little boys in the women's locker room all the time.
Yeah, it depends on the age of the kid.
It really does.
That's true. I often have my daughter in the locker room as well. So, I don't know. It's an interesting story. I think it's probably my second favorite of the stories. I mean, I really like it structurally. I think Samatar is a really fantastic writer. I think the structure of it's really cool. I just don't know if it just kind of feels like a little bit of a missed opportunity to me in the ultimate scale weighing.
Yeah, it didn't quite get there for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted it to.
Yes. I agree with all of that.
And I guess this is another question where this is as scarce on the speculative side as perhaps the first story, the Rachel Swirsky story, is, in that she's created this story of this, perhaps created this idea of the Selkie, but there's no confirmation that Selkies are in this story or that there really is some magical world. I mean, this could easily be read as a story of a girl who, or of a narrator who is, hopes magic is real because it explains why her mom's gone.
Although there is a bit in the last paragraph, the last scene, where they go to the zoo and the seals recognize them.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think it is more on the speculative side of things, because she at least believes it, even if it's simply that she's convinced herself of it. Like, she very much believes it. Whereas in the If You Were a Dinosaur, My Love, she doesn't believe it. She's just speculating. She's just kind of telling herself a story to make herself feel better, and she's aware that she's doing that. Whereas in this case, she's not. She's kind of, if she is making it up, she's not letting herself recognize that she has.
You know, as I'm sitting here, I'm reading this last paragraph, and especially that part that you just talked about and what comes just after, which is where she talks about how she'll react if Mona leaves her, and what she'll have left, and how angry she'll be, and how she'll burn her stuff and hate her forever, and because it's stupid not to be able to breathe. Who ever heard of somebody breathing in one place but not another? Selkie stories are for losers stuck on the wrong side of magic. And
which is an amazing line.
And but to me, that says Selkie stories are for losers stuck on the wrong side of magic. To me, that says that on the as I read that, the more and more convinced I am that this is a story of a girl who's just made this up in her mind to rationalize her life. And it becomes a much more devastating story when you read it that way, I think.
Right, because then there's really no hope of finding the mother there. Like, even if it's that the mother has left versus that the mother is gone, the mother having committed suicide, it's still like the mother made the decision to leave rather than being like called back to the ocean or something like that. So it's a very different kind of finality. Like, it's a lot more final, I guess.
Which connects very interestingly to what you just talked about in the previous story about that relationship between the parent and the child, and the parent not caring whether the child lives or dies.
Yes.
It's actually sort of similar, right? Yes, if that's how you read the story. And that's devastating.
Yes, exactly. And that's why, I mean, and that makes sense. She then come up with that kind of a story to explain it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know, like, you know, when you have, you know, a parent die, you want to rationalize it. You want there to be a reason. At least in my experience, that's what it was like for me.
Mm-hmm.
You want there to be a reason. So I believe that part of the narration, you know?
Well, I will tell you, this story as we've discussed it, has become more powerful to me. Like, I like this story more now that we've talked about it. So.
But again, my reaction to this is it's very, very personal reaction too. So.
Right.
You know.
All right. Well, let's go on to the final story, which is The Water That Falls on You from Nowhere by John Chu. And this is my favorite of the stories. It's also, to me, the most traditional sort of Hugo story. I read it and it just reminds me of a Hugo story. It reminds me a lot of Ken Liu's stories. It reminds me a lot of a lot of the other serially nominated authors in the short fiction category. And so basically the premise is this young man named Matt debating whether or not to come out to his parents. He wants to marry his boyfriend Gus, and he was trying to decide whether or not to come out to his parents. But the problem is, in this world, when you lie, you are doused with freezing water. And so every time he lies, he gets doused with water. And so he can't be around his parents or anybody else who doesn't know that he's gay, because he can't lie about it. And I found that what's so cool about this story, and seems so rare, is we've talked about these other stories, and I find rare in a lot of short fiction. If you remove the speculative element, the story completely falls apart, which I love. What do you think, Jenny?
I don't know that I agree with that, because I think part of what makes it work is the fact that the tension would be real even if he could lie. Like, the fact that you can't lie kind of creates certain situations, but the problems are still there. Like, I think that's why it works. But I really did love the story, and I think it's one of the ones that I actually wish there was an easy way for me to introduce it to, like, the teens at the library, because I think it's one of those that works really well for a lot of different people, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I just absolutely loved this story. Just loved it. I mean, I started reading it and thinking, wow, that's a really strange premise. And then the part where you get to the second paragraph, and he's like talking about, you know, when you say this sentence is false and you get filled with this sense of impending doom, so most people don't last. The note on my piece of paper literally says, so it's kind of like being part of fandom then.
And I kept thinking the whole time reading it of, you can't do that on television. That's just
slime.
I don't know.
It's a very daring opening. I mean, it's like an info dump, which is kind of neat. But it's such an interesting and intriguing premise that you don't really mind it. Like, you're fine reading this little info dump that you need to understand the rest of the story. But it is kind of odd in that regard.
Yeah, it is very info dumpy, but it's an entertaining info dump.
Yes.
Right.
It's like sort of like, you know, because, you know, it's like, you know, everybody was testing the water to make sure it was water. It's like, you know, anybody with a sense of lab safety was doing this.
Right. So that even from the very beginning, when you're info dumping, he's also giving you character and information and character and personality, and sort of talking about people and not just the mechanics of it.
Right. Because if I'm not mistaken, Matt, the main character, is a scientist.
Yeah, he's a biotech engineer, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so kind of talking about the experimental procedures kind of feeds into that, I think. You're right. So the story, what do you think, Natalie, about when I talk about the fact that the speculative element is so central? And I understand what Jenny's saying about the fact that the tension remains whether the speculative element is there or not. But to me, the way the story unfolds and the tension that's created by his inability to be around his parents, the fact that he's had to completely divorce himself from his family for all of these years, not just because he's gay. I mean, he could have lied and still been around them, but he couldn't lie, so he couldn't be around them. And the additional tension that's created with his family, I thought, was really unique and couldn't have been done another way.
I think, you know, having sort of this visible indicator of truth-telling, you know, because the opposite happens too, is when somebody says something that's really, really true, all the sweat evaporates from them.
Yeah, I actually really like that, the fact that it went both ways. I thought that was very clever.
So it's something that goes both ways. So I felt it was really integral to the story too, and I think you can kind of see it more when he gets to his sister's house for the Christmas,
mm-hmm.
where he's having this conversation with her, and it's so tense.
Oh, it's awful. I mean, it just makes your, it's like awful secondhand embarrassment syndrome almost, where you're just cringing at having to be in that room.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to say I liked the sister because she was awful, because she was really awful, but she was awful in a way that made me want to know what her story was.
I thought she was a fantastic character, a very like authentic character to me. Like I could see that character existing, you know?
Yes.
It made me wonder what she had compromised on, what she had given up.
Yeah, and despite how little information we have her, she feels well-rounded, and that's why we have those questions. Like, she clearly has motivations, even if we don't always know what they are. Her motivation isn't actually just to make his life miserable. She just happens to, for whatever reason, that helps her.
Well, and I think one of the interesting things is the parents become very accepting at the end of his lifestyle, or at least willing to accept his sexual identity. And so they have, when they accept it and are willing to continue to include him as part of the family, her anger remains. And I can only wonder, and I'm speculate, is that anger because of her relationship to her mother and all the things her mother has told her about what she wants and what, you know, that how much she wants a grandchild, how much she wants the family to continue, how much she wants these things. And the parents are willing to sacrifice those things for their happy son.
But the mother's not willing to sacrifice that. She says, you know, you're a biotech researcher. Can you give me a grandson with genes from both of you?
Right.
Which I thought was the best line.
I love that part.
You know, like, the parents accept their son for who he is, but they still want that grandson.
Yes. And that felt very, as with so many other parts of the story, that felt very real to me, that was really the real concern, not the propriety of any of it, but just that they wanted that grandson really, really badly.
Well, one thing I really liked about the story is it's sort of, you see the cultural differences, because, you know, these are, you know, Chinese-American families, and not everybody in the sister's house has a language in common. So there's English, and then there's people who speak Cantonese and people who speak Mandarin. But even with all that, you have these commonalities that, like, all families are kind of difficult and complicated. And what the other thing I really liked about the story was the use of the Chinese characters.
Yeah, that was really well done.
Which I thought was great. And I had just read Chu's essay in Book Smugglers about the use of language. And he referenced this, you know, that if you include the characters, you have to provide that information elsewhere. And he does.
On that topic, what I love about that is he is trusting the reader to figure that out. And that's what I didn't like about that Thomas Older Hoifeld story, where he was using other languages to reference things, but then not trusting his reader to figure it out and providing that context. I mean, Natalie pointed out a reason for that maybe, but I love the fact that he's just using it and saying, it's okay that you don't know exactly what I'm saying.
Right. Just like it's okay. You know, the story still works even if you aren't familiar with the dishes that he's referencing. Like, he describes them enough so that the story works and you understand that that's his favorite food, and that's really all you need to know. And if you know more, it makes the story mean more, but the story still works. And as you said, he's trusting us to understand what's going on, even if we don't know the details of all the different parts of it.
Yeah,
he's trusting that the reader's smart enough. Absolutely.
One of the lines in the story that really rocked me from that language perspective was the one where he talks about his mother. His mother's trying to talk to Gus after it's been revealed that Matt and Gus are a couple. And Matt laments how his mother speaking English, how she's not the woman in English that she is speaking her native language, and how sad he is that his partner can't see his mother for the witty, clever person that she is, and how hard he as a son had to work on his own language skills to be able to see his mother and communicate with his mother at the way she wanted to communicate. Like, that was a really powerful statement, I thought.
Yeah, I love that part. Yeah. It felt very honest, and it felt very complicated and layered and just very true to kind of what that situation is like. I'm very respectful of everyone involved in terms of, what it's really like to have to try and communicate in a language that you don't know very well, that you didn't learn to speak as a child.
Well, and the other thing in that scene is at no point does Matt worry about water falling on anybody. Because they're all being just completely honest, which I think is really interesting, because the whole time he's talking with his sister, he's negotiating the edges.
Using weasel words, as he says.
Yes.
And is on guard to the point that he saves his sister from burns. So, and has to.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was really well done, actually. Yeah. That whole, the way he structured that scene.
Yeah.
And the use of the commentary on language, on using questions and on using what he calls weasel words, I thought was really interesting. It kind of informs how we communicate with each other all the time, about how rarely we speak in declaratives. even without the concept of water falling on us when we lie, when we communicate naturally, we use those words. We hedge constantly on our statements. We very rarely use declaratives, I think.
Right. And I mean, there's good reasons a lot of times why we do. But yeah, it's something to be aware of. And you're right that it's very good commentary in this story about that.
Structurally and sort of from a style perspective, this is by far the most linear, traditional story of the four, which is interesting. I know I've reacted to it as my favorite of the stories. And I can't help but think that that's part of it. The fact that this is just a very easy to digest story from start to finish. And despite my commentary earlier that the Hugo stories tend to have this very, emotional payoff, which this one clearly does. But I don't know, like, it works for me that way. I mean, am I being ensnared by simplicity on this one, or am I appreciating simplicity for what it's worth, Jenny?
I don't know. I think there's a difference between simplicity and accessibility. I think it's a very accessible story, but I think that there's layers here that make it complicated that is, I wouldn't really call it that there's simplicity necessarily. I think things being familiar makes a difference in terms of it being accessible. And it seems like Chu has sort of balanced the linear aspect of it and the fact that it is a slightly more traditional, as you're saying, in other ways, with the fact that he is then using language and particularly Chinese characters in a way that, you know, quite frankly, Western literature just does not do, even though it probably, you know, should be more open to. So I think that it's a good, like, that's part of what's going on there, that it's challenging and interesting, but yet not too much. Like, it still gives us room so that we're not constantly on edge as we're reading it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and it's kind of a romance, too, you know?
Yes.
You know, which I really loved. I love that, you know, it's essentially, it's a coming out story.
It's a happy ending.
And it's got a happy, hopeful ending, and nobody's dead at the end. And everybody cares about each other, even if they're really angry at the moment.
Yeah, and I have to say, as cheesy as it is, I kind of do appreciate it for that. I am still really partial to the Swirsky story for all the reasons I said before. But yeah, there's so much about this that I love. And it's all these things that we're talking about, but it actually is a happy ending, and that it's both accessible and challenging at the same time.
So before we declare who the winner will be, I just want to ask you both, are you happy with the ballot? Do you think it is? I mean, it feels to me to be very diverse, and also very, and I'm just not just mean like the type of author, but also in that you got lots of different structures, you've got lots of different cultures, you've got lots of different styles. I mean, to me, it seems like a very diverse and cool list. Do you guys agree?
I do. I'm very sad that there's only four instead of five. Like, I feel like there's a problem there that needs to be fixed somehow. But yes.
Yeah. I generally, you know, it's a pretty varied list, but I wish there were five stories too.
I think that speaks to the short story market is so diffuse. There's just so many stories, and it's not the old days where you had the five magazines and that was where all of them were published. I mean, they're just, they're everywhere now.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've got we've got the new issue of Clark's World. We've got fantasy and science fiction to read. Shimmer came out with a new story today. I mean, that's at least 10, 15 stories right there in one day.
Yeah.
And I think part of what that does is also it goes back to the accessibility, because there's also the issue of not just how readable is the story, and if it's kind of that right level of challenging but not too challenging, which is an awful thing to say, but when you're talking about a popular ballot, it's kind of important. But is also like, how easy are all these things to track down? Like, if someone mentions them to you, like, how easy is it to then go find it and read it? Or how easy is it to remember to do so a month later, kind of a thing? So.
Well, I definitely think that's why we're not seeing any fantasy and science fiction stories here anymore. It's not available online.
There is the Kindle there's a Kindle subscription you can get, but it's not the whole issue. It's like selections from it.
And it's not available with a click like Clark's World is. I mean, you just,
no,
you know.
Yeah, you can't just go to the website and look up the stories.
Yeah.
So, on that note, on the spot, Natalie, who is winning this category? Well, let's say, who do you think will win and who do you wish would win?
Oh, gosh. I think it's going to – I want John Chu to win, but I think it's going to be a tight race between him and Sophia Samatar.
Okay. Jenny?
Well, I think that Chu is going to win, although I will probably still – I mean, maybe I'll reread it and I'll change my mind based on what you guys are saying, but I still think I'm going to put Swirsky's on top, but I'm not going to be sad if Chu wins over it.
Well, for me, I went into this thinking that Chu was going to be, this conversation in particular, that Chu was going to be my choice, and that I also thought that he would win. I still think he will probably win, but I think I'm going to vote for the Samatar story. The more I looked at it, and I'm going to read it again to make sure, but I think that story hits harder than any of the others in it, the way it did it. And it did it in not a cheap way. It does it in a way that's more clever, I think, than just sort of straight up tugging on the heartstrings. I think it does it in a clever way. So that's going to be my choice. We'll see what happens. Chu is a worthy winner. I like both of those. And really, if any of these stories win, I would be disappointed if the older Hoyfeldt story won, but I would be able to understand why, perhaps. So
and I'm interested to see the rest of the nominating ballots to see what that threshold was.
Oh, and how many stories got just – how many stories tied for fifth is the question.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, if they all tie for fifth, I think they put them all on the ballot.
The issue is if they get enough of a percentage.
Right.
Oh, right.
Right. They have to get over 20 – I think it was over 25 votes this year or something. I don't know exactly what the number was, but – it had, but you could have a lot tied, or we could, and I think they only put ties on if they're under a certain number. So, like, if you had 8 stories tied, obviously they're not all going to get on there. I think there's a limit.
Oh.
So it's like, you can have like up to 8 maybe or something like that. I don't know exactly the rules, but there have been talks of changes to the rules on this category to make sure that we get, I think because we only had 3 last year. I mean, you want to talk about complaining about have 4 this year. We only had 3 last year, which was even worse. So
yeah, and that's just a bad track record. Something, whether it's stuff outside that needs to change, which is what we were talking about at the beginning and just recently, or if it's the actual rules to this category that need to change. Yeah, it does seem like something needs to be fixed there.
Well, on that note, we're certainly not going to solve all of the world's problems tonight. But this has been our presentation of the Hugo Awards for Short Story. Thank you so much to Natalie Lurs and Jenny Thurman for being with me tonight.
Thank you.